Publishing Talks, a podcast about books and the publishing business. I'm David Wilk, your host, and today I'm interviewing Dan Halpern, who's the editor of Echo Press. Hi, Dan.
Hi, David. How are you?
I'm good.
Great.
Really good to talk to you today. You, I think, most recently were honored for your achievements, you know, in the literary world, and I think there's a lot of interesting things that you've done in your life. I want to kind of go back to, you know, the early stage of your career. You started out as a writer, correct?
I started out writing poetry because I had a roommate at San Francisco State who had a girlfriend in the dorm next to mine, and he would write poetry in the early part of the evening, and then he would go outside her window and read it to her. And it seemed like a pretty good thing to do with one's time.
It's sort of the romantic view of, and a practical view of poetry at the same time.
But the only practical part of it was
right.
The courting of young women
right.
When you were a young man.
Right, and of course that probably evolved over time. Now, at what point did you realize that you had this interest that ran more deeply? You know, there must have been something that caused you to realize that poetry was going to be important to you.
Probably, you know, beyond that first encounter with it and starting to read it, probably going to live in Tangier at the end of the 60s was where it all began. Paul Bowles had asked me to spend another year after the first year and start a literary magazine with him. So we together began Antaeus. I think we started assembling it in 1968. And in putting that together, a lot of things were involved. Reading more widely, you know, discovering poets and fiction writers who were just starting out, as well as more established writers. There were a lot of people coming through Tangier in those days. Tennessee Williams was there a lot, and William Burroughs and Jean Genet. So it was a great place for a very naive kid who grew up in California.
Well, it gave you a chance to become really seriously involved in literature. You know, clearly you were hanging out with some of the great literary minds of the 20th century.
Well, it was a great opportunity, and Paul, who became very close to me, my father died right at the time I met Paul Bowles, who happened to be in California, and he was the one who told me about life in Morocco and what it was like to be there and living there. So I went over to see him and to see what Tangier was all about, and he ended up becoming certainly one of the most influential people in my life.
Well, I read a piece that you wrote about him in 1999 that I think had a line in it that I think is really descriptive of everything that you've done, and that's, it depends on who comes along.
Well, that is certainly the key line. He inscribed that in one of my books, and he said, things don't happen, it depends on who comes along.
Right, which is almost, to me, the perfect description of a literary life.
Well, maybe anybody's life. I mean, certainly, you know, who you marry, who your friends are, what job you end up undertaking, all of that is so much a function of the people that you meet along the way.
Right, and of course, how you deal with them and interact with them, you know, is a big part of that. So you did Antaeus with Paul Bowles for how many years?
Well, I guess 20-something years.
And Echo Press evolved out of that?
Echo Press evolved. The first issue of the magazine was actually published in 1970. And I think the last issue was somewhere around 95, so maybe 25 years. And when I moved to New York, I was looking for a backer for Antaeus, since there was no money beyond the first issue, which Paul Bowles put up. And I was introduced to a woman named Drew Hines, who said that she would back the magazine if I would begin a press. called Echo. It took a long time before I found out why she named it Echo. She was very secretive about it, very secretive about a lot of things. But Echo turned out to be her favorite dog.
Yeah.
And it's Italian for Echo. And she introduced me to Tom Ginsberg, who was then running Viking. This is before Penguin bought it. And he agreed to teach me about publishing and distribute my books. So it began in 1971. We did a lot of reprints and poetry, since we didn't have very much money to buy books with at that point. So Echo began in 71.
And you ran Echo as an independent for quite a long time. As I recollect, I think it was 1999 you sold to Harper.
That's right. 1999, I sold it to Jane Friedman, who was running HarperCollins. She asked me how it was running an independent press. And at that point, it wasn't that much fun anymore, because we were always trying to raise money, always trying to publish too many books to kind of meet all of our overhead bills. It was just a very different enterprise the last 5 or 10 years.
How many books did you publish, you know, at that point? I mean, again, it's not about numbers so much, but just to get a sense of the scale, how many books were you publishing a year at that point?
About 60, because my wife, Jean Wilmot, took over the financial side, and she tried to just try to get me to focus on the financial side of publishing, which was not my first love. So she decided that in order for us to make this work, we had to publish 5 books a month. So we were doing 60 books by the end, and it was getting more and more difficult to buy books that I really like. The books that we used to be able to get were now being bought up by some of the larger houses that were just buying books on the low end, but their low end was $15,000 to $20,000, and the most we ever paid, I think, for any book was $3,000. So we weren't able to buy the books that we were getting, you know, even 5 years earlier.
Right. So there was sort of as I recall that period, it was kind of the flowering of the era in a certain way, that a lot of writers who had begun with smaller and independent publishers and whose work had been nurtured by independent bookstores became popular enough that the bigger publishers were willing and able to invest in them.
Right. And, you know, I think it was something that made a lot of small press people bitter, that they would establish a writer, work with them on, you know, the editing of their work and promoting it. And when they were successful, the writers were, in some people's minds, stolen by the larger publishing houses who could pay more. But that was never a concern of mine. I understood that was the nature of the thing, that if we published Toby Wolfe in the very beginning, and we published, you know, his first book of stories, and then we published the novella, which won the Penn Faulkner, and it was clear to me that it was only a matter of time before somebody like Tobias Wolfe would be moving on to a larger publishing house. And it seemed right that he do it. I mean, it made me sad, but it was in the nature of things.
Right. I think that's true. And in fact, I've recently read some discussion about, you know, things are different today. Obviously, the cycle has gone, you know, farther along, and books that were previously possible for a big publisher to publish now are not. So the economics have really changed. And
it's ironic, isn't it?
It is. Well, it's maybe it is in the nature of things, as you say.
But I'm not going back.
No, we have to keep going forward.
Exactly.
But in a sense, the dynamics are going to change. I mean, clearly now there are many writers who simply can't be published at all commercially, who were quite successful 5, 10, 15 years ago.
Right. But all of this is changing now so amazingly and so quickly. There are going to be so many different kinds of platforms and vehicles for, you know, disseminating novels and books of poetry and nonfiction titles electronically. So I think the whole landscape is going to be almost unrecognizable.
Well, or recognizable as, you know, possibly for those of us who are around if you think, you know, as you were in the 60s, when there were many, many, many small publishers, literary magazines, you know, smaller than yours, bigger than yours in some cases, but, you know, in some, I know many publishers who did, you know, editions of 300 or whose magazines
right.
might have circulated 500, and the editor would know every single reader just about, and that is very possible with electronic publishing. It kind of circles back that, you know, I've seen lots of literary magazines now starting up that are purely digital.
Right.
And because the cost is almost zero to publish, or writers who can publish their own work, you know, in the guise of it being a blog or whatever you want to call it.
Right.
So there's the circularity. I think you're right that we're going to see tremendous growth, especially as some of the technology costs come down, you know, as it has done with the web, so it will happen with devices, I think, where, you know, if the app is the new publishing platform on the iPhone or the iPad or an Android machine, writers will find them. Publishers will find them as ways to, you know, to get the work out.
Right.
And now, so I guess one question I have for you, since you've, you know, you've continued to write, and I know you edit. I found a book, your most recent book, I thought was really, really interesting. I hadn't seen it before. I decided I wanted to talk to you, and I saw that you had this relatively new book called Who's Writing This? The 55 Writers on Humor, Courage, Self-Loathing, and the Creative Process, which is a great title. Kind of interesting for me because so many of the interviews I've been doing are with writers about their process and, you know, the kinds of things that they talk about.
That book is not too new. We did that initially as an issue of, part of an issue of Antaeus. And then we did a little edition of it before we came to HarperCollins, and then we repackaged it
Okay.
Put it out again.
I wasn't aware of the history, but I think that, you know, that's the kind of book that lends itself to electronic publishing, I think.
Right.
You know, the kind of many short pieces and where you can, you've got lots of different names of writers attached to it, so different people who are interested in different writers can find it. And I guess one of the questions I have for you as you're looking to the future of publishing and editing, you know, how do you feel about the prospects? You know, what do you think is going to happen in the near future and in maybe the middle future and then the long-term future?
You know, it's just watching it unfold here at HarperCollins. The CEO here, Brian Murray, has really been on the cutting edge of working out deals with Amazon and Apple and dealing with the agents and all the, you know, the new contracts that have to be done with all the new electronic stuff that's happening. It's amazing to watch it. And I think it's exciting because for authors, they're going to have so many different platforms. It's a very different kind of publishing than what I first went into back in the 70s. Honestly, I'm glad to watch it happen here. Would I go into publishing again if I were 25 or 23? Probably I would do something a little different than I did before. I have a sentimental and romantic notion of what it means to carry a paperback book around Europe, hitchhiking around Europe, and looking at it 30 years later and seeing the little marginalia, the thoughts you had, the coffee stains that are in the book that are kind of proof that you actually lived through these pages, the phone number of a girl in the back of the book. I like that, and it'll be different. Won't be greater or lesser, just different.
Yeah, I agree. I think different is the marker. But do you think that people, let's say, if you imagined the 23 or 25 year old today who decides that publishing is interesting because of all these possibilities and the differences in platforms and the ability to speak directly to a reader through the device, let's say, you know, if that person then 30 years forward, looking back on her or his career, says, you know, I think that where I find this sentimental attachment to the work is in the electronic connections that I made or in the the notations in the emails and the texts that we sent, rather than in the notations in the margin, because that's the equivalent.
Yeah, I'm sure that there's a parallel. I mean, the kids, I have a 16-year-old daughter, Lily, who everything is on the internet. I mean, she reads books still. She has to because I'm her father. But it's not even her generation. It's a generation or two behind her who will be so electronically focused that they will have a different kind of sentimentality. I can't imagine it.
Well, it may be
so different.
Sentimentality is attached to physical objects more than the transitoriness of electronic objects. So maybe that is a difference. You know, maybe that there will be a redefinition for them. Maybe they'll attach sentimentality not to the printed page in the book, but maybe to some other physical object, because it is hard to imagine attaching sentiment to something that can't physically exist.
Well, I was thinking about this the other day. I came across a letter that was in a copy of The French Lieutenant's Woman by John Fowles, and it was a letter in which he was talking about his poetry. It's a very casual letter. And I got tears in my eyes remembering when it arrived and what prompted it, time I spent with him in Lyme Regis after that book came out. And maybe three generations forward, somebody will read an email and get tears in their eyes, his or her eyes.
Right.
But I can't imagine that one.
Well, no, it's different. It is more difficult to imagine, and partially it's the physicality of the artifact. You know that it's hard to for us, because we come from a paper history, to figure out what things will be like for people who didn't have that paper.
Right.
Well, think about, and of course, every generation has had this challenge of recognizing that, and many people take the view that whatever was before is better than whatever is now. That's the kind of, I think that's an echo of sentimentality.
I don't have that view. I do think that there is something sad about having lost a whole literary genre, the letter. People don't write letters anymore. The email is not like writing a letter. A letter, you know, you were sending it out. It had physical presence, and you know, you typed it a certain way. You put it on the page a certain way, and you wrote it in a certain way. And you don't write emails the way you write letters, especially the way you used to write letters. And when you go back and read through Virginia Woolf's letters, and, you know, the letters by any of the writers who you admired, you know, growing up, that was a certain thing. And I don't know what happens to the people now who are reading, who don't have letters to read, because nobody their age writes letters.
No, and it is very different. I mean, I think there, interestingly, form does dictate content to some extent.
Right.
And I think also, I was thinking about this yesterday myself, I wrote a letter, I sent a book off to somebody with a typed letter in it, because that's what I do. You know, I'll type it on the computer, print it, and then send it off.
You're dating yourself.
Yes, but even more so dating myself. Yet this morning, the guy called me after he got the book, and I wanted to send him another book in a hurry. It's sort of like a conversation in books. So I wrote the letter by hand, and as I was writing it, I was realizing how much more slowly I had to go, and how much differently my thought process was between physical handwriting and typing, not to mention, you know, the difference between typing an actual letter versus typing an email, which is different, as you
right.
say. So, you know, clearly, and there are people who feel strongly that the discipline and necessity of handwriting is something that shouldn't be completely lost. You know, that you sort of think of the monks back in the 13th century transcribing, you know, they were creating the earliest books. That was and when we look at those, we're just kind of agog at the amount of time and energy that went into them. But, well, I think of the amount of the way that caused their minds to work.
Well, and calligraphy.
Yeah, exactly. But very different from the speed. We can, just like everything else, with technology, we can do much more quickly. That doesn't necessarily mean ours is better or that theirs is better. It just means it's different. But whatever experience of the world they had while they were writing down physically is an experience that almost no one today can have.
Oh, that's a great point. When you're writing longhand, you don't leave out words in a sentence because your mind's working at a different kind of pace and it's doing a different thing. When you email, well, I should only speak for myself, my mind is racing ahead much faster than my fingers, so I often leave out words in a sentence that I thought I wrote down, but I said them,
right,
but I didn't write them.
Right. And actually, when you see your own emails, then somebody replies to you and you realize how badly you wrote.
Appalling.
Yeah, it is kind of scary. I think that, you know, think about poetry a little bit, you know, there. You probably know of Robert Duncan's famous arguments with publishers over the reproduction of his work, or maybe not. But he was kind of obsessed with line length and the position of the word on the page,
right,
as he wrote, and you could virtually not transcribe it correctly for him as a typesetter. Because the type works differently than the handwritten word or the typed word even. And he used to have, he would do just endless proofreading or changing of the proofs back from the printer because he couldn't stand to see the way typography changed the meaning of his words.
Well, we have a couple poets like that, and it's admirable. It's frustrating, proving again that it's an imperfect world.
Well, the nature of modern technology maybe obviates that because most poets today won't handwrite or type. They will compose on the computer using Microsoft Word, which in some way is much more similar to the way typography works.
Mm-hmm.
So,
you can see it as you go along. I think, writing poetry for the first time on a computer was an odd experience because you could change the typeface and the size, and you could actually see what it was going to look like in a way that was harder on a typewriter. I mean, you had, one set of keys, and you, which this now dates me.
Oh, sure. I think now the other kind of transformation that may occur is the possibilities opened up by writing in an electronic mode where the page is no longer the same. Instead of a page existing in a finite way in an ebook, it exists as a rendered form, and the screen is different every time. So for a poet who's writing directly to the page, the ebook is, this could be true for a book designer or a writer of any kind, if the pagination matters to you, if the layout of the page is important to your work, the ebook undoes all of that. And it forces you then to rethink the way that you're conceiving your work. And of course, with newer writers, people who are not wed to the form and format of the past, this becomes creativity or the opening to do something new. But for writers who are connected to the past way of doing things, it's a challenge that may be impossible to meet.
Well, the notion of not having pages is a little bit like having a trap door open underneath you. It's an endless free fall into infinity.
Yeah, it's very difficult. I was at I think it might have been a book expo discussion or a presentation where the people who were presenting were talking about print on demand and digital publishing as a way of redefining the workflow. And one of the people in the audience, who was an editor, said, "Well, if you think through what you're saying, what it means is there's no potential end to the process of the writing. In other words, when is a book ever finished if it can always be changed?"
Well, there's that famous saying, is it Valerie who said it? Book is never finished, it's merely abandoned.
Great line. And of course, both for the writer and for the publisher, then that's a really big challenge. And of course, for the bibliographer who will want to kill herself or himself, because versions can be endlessly replicated. In electronic publishing, there is no impediment to revision.
No. No, and if you had to type a perfect page without any whiteout or any typos, you could type that page 10 times to get it right. Once you had it right, you probably left it alone.
Right. But you might not now.
Unless you're a Marion Moore or Auden, and then you go back and revise 20-year-old poems.
Right. But so you're, and of course, today, if you are an author and you create your own work using electronic publishing mechanisms, technology, you can essentially continue that process, as you said, into infinity, which makes it more difficult for the reader who is interested, or even for the publisher who is interested in some sort of a product rather than a process.
Yeah, exactly.
But that could be, that's something that we can't really predict, but looks like a really interesting possibility, and that is that publishing books becomes more of a social interaction and a community event rather than simply a product.
Right, but you don't want to lose closure along the way.
Well, that's the question. Isn't that a question? I mean, that's sort of an interesting point. I think some people might argue that you will lose closure along the way. Not necessarily whether that's good or bad, again, as a value, but I think clearly you're saying as an editor and as a publisher and maybe even as a writer that closure is important.
Closure is very important, it seems to me. I mean, there are books written on how you end something. And, of course, we know that the final closure, at least for the foreseeable future, if that's not a contradiction, remains out there waiting to get you.
Well, do you think is that sort of a spiritual, almost a spiritual sense? You talked about, again, this kind of comes circular that, or full circle to something that you said about Paul Bowles, that he was the existentialist for you. And maybe what you just said is that's an existential statement about culture.
Well, it either derives from my early experiences with Paul Bowles, or my experience last weekend going to see my mother in an old people's home, where the end is so physically present in those places. Maybe it's a combination of both.
Well, that's kind of fraught also, I think, that as we tend to think about the future as being never-ending, of course, at the same time, it always does end.
So far.
It's just we're not always around to see it end.
Right.
This is an interesting conversation because we've kind of gone into philosophical and spiritual almost thinking when I was really, when we were just starting to talk about books. But I think it kind of says a lot about who you are as a publisher and editor, that it's the ideas and the kind of underlying sense of being that is what you're most interested in.
Nope. I feel closure hovering.
I think so. Well, it's been great talking to you, Dan. This is David Wilk for Publishing Talks, a podcast about books and the publishing industry. Thanks so much.
Thanks, David.